The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles principally from the Mayo Clinic health letter. And I'm going to start with the issue of January 2024 and continue to read a section called Second Opinion. Question. I recently switched diabetes medications. I'm now occasionally waking up sweating and feeling lightheaded. Could the two be related? Bring this to your healthcare team's attention. One possible cause of your symptoms is having too little sugar in your blood. This is known as hypoglycemia. Hypoglycemia is fairly common and can be serious. It can happen anytime, but is more likely to happen overnight, when you go an extended period without food or fluids. People with type 1 diabetes are much more likely to have hypoglycemia, but the risk increases in people with type 2 diabetes who take insulin or related drugs, including sulfonylureas like glipizide, glimepiride, and gliburide, to manage the disease. When blood sugar drops too low, you may feel weak, dizzy, nervous, sweaty or hungry, or you may have blurred vision or a rapid heartbeat. If blood sugar drops further, symptoms may progress to headache, confusion, slurred speech, or acting drunk. Severe or prolonged episodes can be fatal. Older adults are especially vulnerable because even minor cases of hypoglycemia can lead to dangerous falls. Repeated hypoglycemia events may increase the risk of heart trouble in older adults. If you notice symptoms of hypoglycemia developing, check your blood sugar. If you know that these are symptoms of hypoglycemia, or if the number is below 70, take about 15 grams of easily digestible carbohydrate, a few pieces of hard candy, 4 ounces of a full sugar soft drink, 4 ounces of fruit juice, 4 to 5 packets of sugar, or 4 glucose tablets intended especially for treating hypoglycemia. If after 15 minutes you continue to experience symptoms, repeat the treatment. If symptoms don't go away, call for emergency assistance. To help prevent overnight incidence of hypoglycemia, avoid taking correction insulin doses at bedtime. If you take a fast-acting insulin injection at bedtime, be sure to get up at about 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. to check your blood sugar. Stick to your usual meal and medication schedule. Timing matters to maintain a steady supply of sugar throughout the day and night. Follow a regular bedtime routine as well. If you exercise or drink alcohol within hours of sleeping, eat extra food to bolster any associated drop in your blood sugar. Your healthcare team may suggest wearing a continuous glucose monitor if you're not already using one, and may adjust your medications, both which drugs you take and at what times you take them. Now again from the Mayo Clinic health letter of January, I'm going to read a longer article, but one that covers an important topic, and that is knee replacement. If you have arthritis in your knee, many treatments exist that can help relieve the pain and improve function. These treatments include non-prescription and prescription oral pain medications, cortisone injections, knee braces, and physical therapy. But if these measures are not enough and your symptoms make it tough to complete your daily activities, it may be time to talk to your healthcare team about knee replacement surgery. This surgery is also known as knee arthroplasty. Knee replacements are complex operations, and techniques used to precisely implant replacement parts more closely mimic a natural knee joint continue to evolve. Knee replacements are typically expected to last for decades. The thigh bone or femur, the shin bone or tibia, and the kneecap or patella come together at the knee joint. Where these bones meet, the surfaces are covered by a firm, slippery tissue called cartilage. Two rounded pieces of thick, rubbery cartilage called menisci provide cushioning between the shin bone and the thigh bone. These features help the ends of your leg bones and the underside of your kneecap to move smoothly. There are multiple hereditary and environmental factors that can result in damage to the protective cartilage and lead to degeneration of the joint. The most common factor is osteoarthritis, which occurs when the cartilage around the end of the bones deteriorates, often worsening with age. Eventually, symptoms can impair your day-to-day activities. It may be painful to walk short distances, to get out of chairs, or to climb stairs. The surfaces of the knee joint are covered by a firm, slippery tissue called cartilage. In osteoarthritis, the cartilage around the ends of your bones deteriorate. In total knee replacement, artificial replacement parts called prostheses are inserted into the thigh bone, shin bone, and kneecap. An orthopedic surgeon can examine your knee and images of your knee to see if a knee replacement is a good option. During surgery, damaged parts of the knee are removed and metal and plastic parts are implanted. For some people, total knee replacement is best, while partial knee replacement is an option for others. In total knee replacement, an incision is made in the knee and the damaged cartilage is cut away. Your surgeon takes out a fairly thin amount of bone, about 1/4 to 1/2 inch from the end of the thigh bone, the top of the shin bone, and sometimes from the underside of the kneecap. Artificial replacement parts called prostheses are inserted into the thigh bone, shin bone, and sometimes the kneecap. Most of these parts are affixed with bone cement. Others are secured over time by new bone growth on the prosthesis. As part of the surgery, the meniscus is removed. Instead, a plastic spacer functions as artificial cartilage between the metal replacement parts. Your knee has strong bands of tissue called ligaments that help join your shin and your thigh. In a total knee replacement, the surgeon typically removes the anterior cruciate ligament, or ACL, and may remove the posterior cruciate ligament, or PCL. Other major ligaments and tendons in the knee will be left in place and balanced to ensure optimal function with the new joint. The surgery may be done under general anesthesia, or the lower half of the body may be numbed, such as with a spinal block. It's commonly an outpatient surgery, but some people may require a short hospital stay. Major risks include infection, blood clots, and the need for future reoperation. While knee prostheses available today are very good, they typically can't fully mimic the way knees naturally move. You may find that your knee feels stiff, has a more limited range of motion, or makes clicking sounds when you walk. You may need to avoid high-impact activities like jogging, jumping, and contact sports. But for many people, knee replacement eases pain and provides a better quality of life. The knee joint includes three parts: the inside medial compartment, the outside lateral compartment, and the patellofemoral compartment, where the kneecap meets the thigh bone. If arthritis has affected only one of these parts, your healthcare team may suggest a smaller prosthesis to replace just the damaged part. This surgery is called partial knee replacement or unicompartmental knee replacement. Partial knee replacement surgery used to have a somewhat bad reputation. This was because the replacements were sometimes used inappropriately. However, advancements have markedly improved the reliability and durability of the operation. Because this procedure is less extensive than total replacement, recovery tends to be faster. It may be done as a same-day outpatient surgery. A partial replacement also may feel and move more like a natural knee. One reason is that a partial replacement allows you to keep your ACL and PCL, maintaining the knee's natural stability. But this type of surgery is a good fit for only some people. It's not typically performed with inflammatory arthritis like rheumatoid arthritis, because this type of arthritis tends to affect more than one part of the knee. And it's possible for another part of the knee to wear out over time, making a total knee replacement necessary later. Risks of partial knee replacement are similar to risks with total replacement. The operation may be done under general anesthesia or with the lower half of the body numbed. Surgical advances. For any knee replacement surgery, the goal is a knee that functions as well and as painlessly as possible. One difficult aspect of joint replacement surgery is placing the individual components of the artificial joint in the best possible alignment so they will work smoothly. To that end, innovations like robot-assisted surgery and augmented reality technologies aim to improve how the bones are cut, the ligaments are balanced, and the prosthesis is placed. It is truly an exciting time for knee replacement surgeons and their patients, says Mayo Clinic orthopedic surgeon Cameron K. Ledford. These technological advances allow us to create individual plans before surgery and tools to precisely fine-tune and execute that plan during surgery. Traditionally, surgeons use physical instruments known as jigs to help them know where to cut the bone and place the prosthesis. In robot-assisted surgery, certain information about the person having surgery is entered into a computer. This information may be an image, like a CT scan or an X-ray taken before surgery, or it may be measurements of the bones taken in the operating room. This data is used to create a 3D model of the knee. During surgery, the surgeon inserts sensors in the patient's knee, which the computer can read with camera and confirm the 3D plan. The computer then displays a custom-made map of the simulated knee. The surgeon uses the map to see where to cut and at what angle, the amount of bone to remove, where to place the prosthesis, and how to best balance the ligaments. A robotic arm can provide tactile, visual, and auditory feedback to assist the surgeon. This helps ensure that the surgical plan is followed more precisely. The robotic arm also can prevent the surgeon from moving out of the target area. For example, it can ensure that just enough but not too much bone is removed. We're collecting digital data like the shape of the bone and the alignment of the leg. Then the computer is assisting us with that information and displaying where we should cut back onto the screen, says Mayo Clinic orthopedic surgeon Michael J. Taunton. This helps us make the knee replacement fit better and have better alignment of the limb after surgery. In robot-assisted surgery, surgeons sometimes have to take their eyes off of patients to observe the screen, and sometimes the surgery requires rolling large pieces of machinery in and out of the room. That's where the use of augmented reality may help. Dr. Taunton uses augmented reality to assist in knee replacement surgery. During surgery, he wears a helmet with cameras that record information from sensors inserted in the patient's knee. The helmet has a transparent visor that's placed over part of his vision. This visor displays digital information about where and how to operate. Think of a fighter pilot in a jet with a visor over their eyes that displays electronic data overlaid over what they're seeing in the real world. In a medical setting, this technology gives us the ability to get real-time feedback on what we're doing while keeping our eyes on the patient. Dr. Taunton says it's too early to make conclusions about outcomes with the use of augmented reality and knee replacement. But he believes this surgery allows him to make more precise and accurate bone cuts with more correct angles to allow for straighter limb alignment. Hopefully, this will improve people's satisfaction with the surgery and reduce the need for further surgery. Many people having first-time knee replacement could be candidates for surgery with augmented reality, Dr. Taunton says, but this has not been adequately tested on revision knee surgery. Presently, augmented reality for knee replacement is not widely available. Now I'm going to read a shorter article in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter entitled Morton Neuroma. The pain burns. It radiates from the middle of your foot to the tips of your toes. With every step you take, it feels like there's a pebble in your shoe. But there's no pebble, not even a wrinkle in your sock, and you can't feel a bump on the bottom of your foot. How do you make it stop? Morton neuroma involves a thickening of the tissue around one of the nerves leading to the toes. There are many names for this common condition, including interdigital neuroma, Morton metatarsalgia, interdigital neuritis, and plantar neuroma. But whatever you call it, numerous measures can provide relief. Five bones called the metatarsals run through the middle of your foot to your toes. Four gaps, known as web spaces, lie between each of the metatarsals. A complex network of nerves and tendons runs along the bottom of each foot. Morton neuroma happens when one or more nerves in a web space get pinched due to thickening of nearby tissues. It's believed that compression of the nerve may trigger swelling and cause thicker tissue to form in and around the nerve. It can happen anywhere along your foot, but most commonly occurs between your third and fourth toes. Women are five times more likely to develop Morton neuroma than are men. You feel the condition with every step. You may experience it as a minor irritation, feeling like you're stepping on a marble or pebble, or a persistent burning or a sharp pain in the ball of your foot may spread into your toes. You also might experience numbness or a tingling sensation in your toes. The tissue thickening of Morton neuroma happens internally, so it generally doesn't cause a visible bump. You may find that removing your shoe and rubbing your foot helps relieve the pain. Factors that appear to contribute to Morton's neuroma include footwear. Wearing high-heeled, tight, or ill-fitting shoes can place extra pressure on your toes and the ball of your foot. Activities. Repetitive movement or sports like running, jogging, and basketball cause trauma to your feet. Activities that feature tight shoes like snow skiing or rock climbing can also put pressure on your toes. People who have bunions, hammer toes, high arches, or flat feet are at a higher risk of developing Morton's neuroma. You may be referred to a foot doctor to diagnose the problem. Usually a medical professional examines the affected area and applies pressure to pinpoint the pain's origin. The exam may involve rolling a small coin along the footbed to see where it hurts. Imaging, like an X-ray or ultrasound, is often done to check for other common causes. To manage the discomfort, your care team may recommend adjusting how you treat your feet. You might switch from high heels or other form-fitting footwear to wider, comfortable, loose-fitting shoes. Scale back or stop high-impact sports. And add shoe inserts, called orthotics, or metatarsal bars for cushion during foot strikes. These simple measures often provide pain relief within days and resolve any symptoms within weeks. If the pain persists, your care team may recommend a steroid injection to reduce swelling and inflammation. For more severe pain that's not improving, surgery may be considered. Surgery is the most effective treatment, but it's usually considered the last option. Procedures include decompression surgery. For some people, surgeons can relieve the pressure on the nerve by cutting nearby structures, like the ligament that binds some bones together in the front of the foot. Another possibility is nerve removal. Surgical removal of the affected nerve may be necessary if other treatments fail. Although surgery is usually successful, the procedure can cause permanent numbness in the affected toes. Now I'm going to read a short section called Seeking Online Information. The internet holds a vast amount of medical information. It's important to not use what you read online to diagnose or treat health conditions. Instead, discuss your concerns with your healthcare team. But if you want additional information, use these tips to tune in on reliable online sources. First, you should always check the address. Sites that end in .gov are from government agencies. Sites with .edu are from academic institutions. Sites with .org are generally nonprofit organizations. Sites with .com are from commercial entities. Sites with any ending can be reliable, but use the most cautions around .com sites. They may have profit motives that are not always transparent. Check the About Us page. A reputable site or app generally has at least basic information about who runs it, which institutions are affiliated with it, and who funds it. Also check for a Contact Us option or something similar for user feedback and questions. Check the date. Reliable sources tend to include a date on each page, telling you when the information was current. A lack of date doesn't disqualify the site, but proceed with more skepticism. Check the sources. Reliable sites often list their sources of information, usually including links to established guidelines or quality medical studies. Check the privacy. Be skeptical of sites or apps that ask for personal information or use high-pressure sales tactics. Some sites require you to register with an email address and password, but asking for a social security number, a credit card, or bank information is a red flag. Do not share sensitive information without first checking with a trusted relative, financial services, or a medical personnel. Now I'm going to review a section called Chapped Lips or Something More. Your lips feel like they're on fire, but you haven't been eating anything spicy. Chapped lips are to blame. Chapped, dry lips can show up after your mouth is exposed to dry winter air or burning summer sun, or sometimes out of the blue. Fortunately, there are simple, effective measures that can help provide balm to your lips. The simplest solution to dry, irritated, or cracked lips is a lip balm. What's in that product can make a big difference, though. It could help you or hurt you. The American Academy of Dermatology advises on the ingredients in the box below when you have chapped lips. And this goes on to say that the ingredients you should avoid are camphor, eucalyptus flavors, fragrance, lanolin, menthol, octinoxate, oxybenzone, phenol, propylgalate, and salicylic acid. And the ones that you should try are castor seed oil, ceramide, dimethicone, hemp seed oil, mineral oil, petrolatum, shea butter, and white petroleum jelly. It says that if your lips tingle or burn when you're using a lip product, your lips are being irritated. You should always opt for hypoallergenic choices without scents, if possible. It goes on to say that if you unknowingly use a lip, skin, or beauty product that you're allergic to, or your skin is irritated by, this could result in red, scaly, itchy, tender, or swollen lips. This is called contact dermatitis. If you suspect a cosmetic culprit, stop using it and see if the irritation resolves. Your healthcare team may suggest a patch test to identify the cause of your reaction. To clear up contact dermatitis, it may be helpful to use topical medication like hydrocortisone or tacrolimus ointment, but consult your healthcare team first. Another possible lip condition is actinic keratitis. In this condition, your lip, usually an area on the lower lip, may be consistently dry and feel like sandpaper. The lip may look swollen. There may be one or more scaly whitish patches. Actinic keratitis usually results from long-term exposure to UV radiation like that from the sun. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.